in association with Newsarama. Welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. It's time for part two of my conversation with Matt Fraction. Now, we have this part two because Matt wanted to go into detail about Casanova 14, the latest issue of his Image series with Fabio Moon, but we didn't want to spoil until the issue was released. So what you're going to get today is a full rundown of Casanova 14 and that second story arc. And then, as usual, Matt and I leave some time for some random conversation about various pop culture subjects that range from the direct market, some thoughts on Jack Kirby and Steve Gerber, to Matt and my love for the great Dean Martin. This episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by InStockTrades.com. At InStockTrades, they offer a huge selection of trade paperbacks, hardcovers, essentials, showcases, archives, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more, all at up to 35% off, with orders over $50 receiving free shipping. And right now, you can pick up the first collection of Casanova, which is available both in hardcover and trade paperback. The hardcover retails for $24.99. The in-stock trade price, $15.74. Or if you'd like the trade paperback, it retails for $12.99. And at in-stock trades, just $8.18. And don't forget to visit in-stock trade's sister site, Discount Comic Book Service, at dcbservice.com for all your pre-order needs. Major publishers have 40% off, and monthly specials are 45 to 75% off every month. Visit in-stock trades at in-stocktrades.com and Discount Comic Book Service at dcbservice.com. Without further ado, we take you to our conversation with Matt and pick things up as we discuss Casanova 14. So, dude, you finished Casanova. Unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
Well, I got to ask. I mean, should I feel guilty about, the hard-ons that I had for Zephyr through most of this arc?
Casanova is nothing if not an opportunity to explore complex issues of gender and sexuality. So, as long as, Plato was right, the unexamined life is not worth living. So if you maybe ask yourself some questions you normally wouldn't have asked, then our job here is done.
Well, and now the great thing is to go back and reread, Zephyr's dialogue and the narrative that was going on, and clearly there were other things going on that now make sense.
Yeah, and my favorite was one that I didn't even get until you pointed it out to me, which is that the whole storyline is about this giant hidden dick.
In the island.
This giant gun phallic symbol being built in the middle of nowhere that no one can find, which just goes to show how deeply I examine what I do. I told Kelly Sue that last night, and she just completely lost her mind. She's like, oh, that's great. It's like, I know, it never occurred to me.
Well, I'm glad that I could point that out. I'm Dr. Freud there for you.
Yeah, exactly.
Matt, are you trying to tell us something about this island with the hidden gun over here?
apparently so. Yeah, I don't know. A lot of Cass has always been about kind of challenging the genre tropes of spy fiction, and, I don't know what to make of it, but I'm sure happy with it.
Well, it is. It's great. And again, I think the key to a story like this is once you get to this kind of O. Henry surprise, that you are able to go back now and really reread the arc and appreciate it on a different level. I can't even, imagine trying to write something like that where here's the mechanism and now you know. So now why don't you go back and start over again, because now everything else will kind of make sense and fall into place.
Yeah, it actually kind of ruined a dinner with me and Kelly Sue when I came up with it. Because I always sort of knew what the storyline was about. But I just originally, it was just going to be Cass was like deep, deep undercover, and everyone, the reader, was going to think that Cass had turned into a bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
Was really sort of what it was just going to be a much more standard reveal when I initially conceived it. But when I came up with the twist of actually having Cass be Zephyr, I was so delighted. It was like a night. It was like a Friday night, and Kelly Sue and I had date night, and it was like one of the last times she could have sushi. I don't remember. Maybe actually, no. You know what? She was pregnant and couldn't have sushi. But we went to a sushi place when I had sushi and she had something else. But I couldn't stop thinking about it. I couldn't stop clearly I ruined date night because I was writing all night. You know what I mean? I was there. I was in the room with her. I was sitting across the table from her. I was looking and talking, but clearly I was just on. I was thinking about Casanova. So. once again, Casanova is a lot more than a comic to me, and I don't quite necessarily understand why or how, but stuff like that happens all the time.
Well, and now, he's back working for his father.
Right. We find ourselves sort of where we were at the beginning of one.
Yes.
In this kind of, he's very much under his father's sway. He's very much, there's no more secrets, there's no more, everybody knows everything.
Yeah, it's
by,
all out.
Volumes in. And that was kind of a dangerous to me as a writer. Like I had, as I started to write it, I realized the more and more I wrote that everything was going to have to come out in the wash for the landing to stick.
Mm-hmm.
That it was really going to have to be a leveler, and I wasn't going to have these kind of fallback crutches like, oh, I could always tell the story about what really happened to so-and-so, or I could really do that. You know what I mean? It was like, nope, if you're going to pull this off, it's got to be a game changer. It's got to really be a sort of a be-all, end-all, no more secrets. And so really, when Volume 3 starts, we're going to be like a tabula rasa in a lot of ways.
That's outstanding. I think that's great. I love the sheepishness and the sadness that he has about deceiving the Bendis, and you know, especially obviously the Bendai he fucked.
Which is really, you know, and it was the kind of thing like, what do you do when you were just pretending, but it all becomes true anyway? You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Well, that's what I noticed when I went back to read this final issue, and I'm looking at, you know, again, his narrative and, you know, the way he's speaking and everything. And you suddenly realize it wasn't Zephyr saying these things. It was Cass saying these things.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, ends up, oh, what do you, you know, and it's even a thing too, the very first time we see the two of them in Casanova 9, Zeph says, he's totally not my boyfriend. you know what I mean? And
yep.
And sort of, very, you know what I mean? So it's all kind of this dumb stuff like that, where I was, you know, I hope there's value in a second read, because I sure tried to make it have stuff like that kind of all throughout. So hopefully that pays off.
No, I think
that sounds like you thought it did. So
absolutely, no, I'm delighted, Matt. I you know, like I said, I I enjoy your mainstream stuff, and I like when you. When there are no boundaries to where you can go in a story, and I think Casanova is pretty evident that's the kind of book that it is.
I think I'm a pretty imaginative Marvel work, but there's never going to be gender bending like that.
And talk about the framing of each scene and using the Casanova soundtrack that you've kind of compiled here.
Yeah, I sort of, when you readers of Casanova, you'll see that I've there's a soundtrack kind of integrated into. First off, it was just kind of an opportunity to do something that you don't really see in comics. Just that kind of, I think, you know, if you, there's a, you know, Nemesis the Warlock, the old 2000 AD series that Pat Mills wrote and Kevin O'Neill and a bunch of other people.
No, I'm not aware of that one specifically.
It's great. It's super berserk. Kieran Gillen turned me onto it.
And okay.
It's just a delight. But it was originally, it started with, and they had this little logo in the opening of the stories that says Comics Rock. And the initial stories were inspired by different songs. And so it would say Comics Rock and have these like little like music notes dancing around and say like, this story inspired by the Jams, you know, songs, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So I was kind of thinking about that. Like it's sort of like a way of really kind of tying the various different cultures that form cast together, and especially after the last issue itself, like I knew everything that had to happen, but I couldn't do it, I had no way in, and Fabio was getting more and more done on 13, and my time was running out, and one night just kind of driving around, that first song came on, Paper Planes by MIA came on. And suddenly the entire issue was in my head, just all of it was right there, which I'd never had happen before. I mean, it was just a matter of typing. And I was able to end up like typing the issue in like 2 days, and not even, you know what I mean? It was a night and a half of work to get Casanova 14 on the page.
Wow. And this is 32 pages as opposed to the usual 16, or I should say 26 pages.
Yeah, it's 26 pages. Yeah, yeah. So it was just there. All of it was there. I've never had that happen before. It was the weirdest thing. And when I came back to write it, I was worried that I would lose it. I was worried that it would go away. So I just tried to keep myself in that trance. But I just listened to the song again and again and again. And then the idea came to me that, well, like every couple of pages, you should put in a different song that kind of defines what the descending issues were to you. So the first song is really the 14th issue kind of single, and then the second song is the 13th issue, and you know what I mean? So it kind of became this weird thematic summary and a mixtape, and it became this very big, weird everything Casanova is about for me personally kind of came out in making that tape, making that mix. That mix really defines what that book is, what that book was, and yeah. So anyway, I totally sound like a crazy person when I talk about Casanova. Every time I talk about it, I tell myself, like, this time I'm not going to sound crazy. This time I'm going to just sound like a normal guy, and I always come off sounding like a fucking, like tinfoil hat wearing hobo, like on the L train, just like trying to explain to you about the Rays.
Not at all. No, this is stream of consciousness. This is back matter as it's coming out of you. I think that's
exactly,
good, man.
Exactly. So live without a filter.
That's exactly right.
As you know, I've referred to Casanova 14 as the career ender in my house. So.
Well, yeah, we'll see how many of. Wait a minute now. He's a she.
Yeah, I can't wait to see what the reaction is. And you know, the first half of the book was really sexualized.
Absolutely.
You know, there's a part of it that was, you know, dude, if I was a chick, I would play with my boobs all the time. like at least for the first couple of days, I do nothing but play with my boobs. So there's part of it was that. You know what I mean? Like it's kind of a base level of things. But like, yeah, it's a sexualized. Like, of course, guess a woman's going to completely explore sexuality as a woman just to see what it's like, you know? But now you have to go back and deal with the fact that, hey, guys, check it out. It was a dude.
Well, and I love Sasha Lisi. I really did.
Oh, yeah. I tried so hard to get her into. It's great. There's always a character from Mott, and Mott, as we kind of discover, is the sort of like the CIA of the future, or of like the time, like the CIA of like future space time or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The space time protector, I think they're called. And it's funny, is in each volume, there's a character from Mott that I keep trying to get in, and I keep trying to get in, and I can never manage to fit him in. In volume one, it was Sasa, and then in volume two, it's this character called Polonius Godchild, who will be revealed as being the head of Mott. But I was convinced I was going to get him in, and I couldn't do it. So that's good. Maybe in volume three, there will be yet another Mott character that I can't find room for.
I like Zeno declaring that he's Thomas Pynchon at the end of the story and challenging it.
You know, I'll do anything for a blurb, really, an introduction, a pull quote. So maybe trying to goad Thomas Pynchon into a lawsuit.
Well, that'll be a nice.
I stand by what Zeno said. Let Thomas Pynchon go on CNN and prove otherwise. Prove to me that he's not Newman Zeno.
No, it's, you know, that's what I love about Casanova, breaking the fourth wall, unconventional stories, and, you know, starting with, as we said, the super spy tropes, but taking them into directions that, you know, you've never seen before. And, man, once again, Fabio, much like Gabriel, just gorgeous art.
What a talent. Just those guys. The twins, they're actually, I'm not making that up, they're real twins. You know what I mean? Like, in a book about twins, it's drawn by twins who are as ridiculously talented as anyone in the business. I can't believe how great and how gifted they are.
And some of these scenes are just, you know, great, like Thunderball. I mean, they evoke those classic Bond kind of moments and S.H.I.E.L.D. moments as well. You know, there's that for Thunderball, and I forget which artist it was that did it, but I think it was for the soundtrack, the movie soundtrack. And also, I know there were a series of motion picture posters that they made that were just like depictions of some of the underwater scenes.
You
know what I'm talking about?
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, and I mean it's that kind of, you know, imagery that comes alive in this issue, and that's the kind of feeling I got from looking at Fabio's stuff and some of those, you know, great scenes. So
and he's completely without that frame of reference.
That's outstanding.
Being Brazilian.
That's true.
You know, I can refer to Diabolic, I can refer to all this stuff, and he's like, yeah, I don't know what you're talking about. Which is cool. So then, you know, there's if anyone's derivative, it's me. you can't blame him of it because he doesn't, you know.
Well, I don't mean to say too that it is, you know.
No. I know it is,
that he's stealing or anything. Not at all. I mean, it's just they're gorgeous, giant, beautiful spectacle scenes. Oh, you know, you do that in Iron Fist as well. I mean, or your artists do it.
Of course.
So
and Ed, you know, the idea for the storyline came when Ed looked at his wife's Enter the Dragon poster. It's like, oh, we need to do a Kung Fu tournament story. that's where it came from.
Sure.
Literally, oh, we got to do a tournament. I was like, great, there's the second storyline.
Outstanding. Well, now that we've wrapped up this, you know, arc of Casanova, the book kind of rest for a while? What's going to happen?
Yeah,
what's
the future? The boys are going to go do some other stuff, put some more work out into the world that I sadly for myself won't be involved with. And I believe one of it is a project that they're writing together, or Fabio was writing for Gabriel. I don't, you know, there's all kinds of stuff that work that they're going to be putting out, and it's going to be a while before we all get back to Casanova as a team. But with big plans when we do, and I just couldn't be more excited for it. It's always hard to not work on Casanova, so this is going to be a long year for me.
How long will it be before this arc becomes a trade?
That's a good question. I'm not entirely sure. I should have that figured out soon, though.
Okay.
Well, in the hopefully not long.
Okay. In the meantime, you know, and obviously the only place you can get the back matter is by
exactly.
getting the single issue. So
yeah,
check it out.
I think I'm a little since volume two is so far away. I might take some time. I'm gonna I think maybe try and resolicit the single issues just as kind of a last chance to get the stuff before the collections.
Because
people come across the book and you know, as trade, don't know that there's back matter there, don't know that, you know, that there's sort of this exclusive content that will not be reprinted. I think I'm going to try to get the word out on the issues again, and then I'll get around to doing a trade later, probably in the fall.
Okay. That's cool. Well,
we'll see.
It's the same thing I tell Brubaker as well. I mean, you guys are smart because it forces me, and I'm happy to do it, to pick up the magazines as opposed to waiting for the trade because
Well, that's the thing. Without guys like you, there's no trade.
I understand.
You know what I mean? Ultimately, it's demand. It's sales numbers on the singles that dictate is there an audience for a trade? You know what I mean? And ultimately, it's people who read the magazine that pay for Ba to draw pages. You know what I mean? So it's all, thank you for that. Without you, there would not be Casanova.
Well, I hope.
Without you, there wouldn't be Criminal. You know what I mean?
No, I understand. And I know the readers of the magazine appreciate you guys when you say that. And we're happy to support it because it is. It's great stuff. I, much like Criminal, I hope this is finding a European audience as well. I don't know how Luxuria did there, you know, in the European market.
It actually hasn't been reprinted over there.
No kidding.
So I would,
or South America?
Yeah, I'm just here as far as I know.
Really? Oh, man, I think this would do so well over there.
It's very European, isn't it?
Absolutely. I really think so.
I did get berated. Apparently my French was a little off. I did get berated by a French reader. my French in the first issue was apparently not perfect.
Oh, well.
Yeah, well, he's lucky we saved his ass in WW2. That's what I told him.
I just honestly I love what the guys have done art wise in the two arcs as well, and again the bichrome look of the two color look I think is so distinct, and I can appreciate that it might be a barrier and might keep people from wanting to try a book, and that makes no sense to me. I mean,
it's easy for retailers to dismiss black and white books, readers dismiss black and white books, really, and one color is closer to black and white than it is two colors, so, or full color, you know what I mean? So, it's just one of those things where, for my money, Love and Rockets is one of the finest comics ever produced in the English language, and there are people who don't read it because it's in black and white, people who won't order it because it's in black and white. It's just, you know what I mean? It doesn't matter. The content of the book ultimately is meaningless. There's some times when form really, really trumps content. So
it's crazy.
It's the nature of the beast. What can you do?
Well, you were saying when we spoke last in an abortive attempt at trying to do this episode that when you do bring Cass back, you might change and make it a full color book.
Believe when we do volume three, I believe we'll have a broader palette. It's a little early. I need to kind of prove. I see it in my head in a way that I know will work. I need to be able to convince the twins. The twins for a long time had really sort of only colored their own work. And kind of didn't believe that anyone else could do it in a way that they would like. And then Gabriel worked with the genius Dave Stewart on Umbrella Academy and mm-hmm. saw, like, okay, so only me and Fabio and Dave Stewart can color it. So you know what I mean? Like resistance is fading. Like they can be swayed if they see work and if I give them a chance to fall in love with it. So we gotta, if I can find the right colors and someone who'd be willing to basically audition, which I understand is, you know, kind of a big thing to ask and insulting to a lot of people, but you know, it's just the way it's going to get done. So hopefully we'll be able to find a look that makes sense with the book, that fits in, that doesn't feel like a complete alien choice to make. And hopefully when we come back, you know, it'll give people more reasons, more retailers will check the book out that otherwise would have ignored it.
Who colors Criminal for Ed?
I believe Val Staples.
Okay, I wasn't certain if it was Val or not. Yeah, I mean, because I think I can appreciate the fear on their part, because
Val's,
you know,
great. Val's terrific.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I was going to say. There's an example of it being done right. I always felt that way about inkers and colorists, I guess, as well. You know, you go back to the 80s when Gene Colan did Nathaniel Dusk with Don McGregor, and it really is this great 30s noir story. And unfortunately, the colorist just literally, like, it's like he's using liquid paper over those subtle Colan, you know, lines of pencil and ink. And it's still beautiful Colan art, but you know what's underneath those colors, and it's just lost. And it really is. I'm not an artist, but I just know, as someone who appreciates great art, that you just know what's underneath there, and it's like, oh, that's such a shame. There's great Colan under there. Or even when we were talking in that last episode of Word Balloon about how you were inspired by the page of Kirby art in Thor that just had inks on it. I don't even know. Was it Vinnie Coletta inks or?
Oh, it was. Oh gosh.
Sinnott?
Andy is going to freak out if I don't play it.
Andy Parks.
This is Andy Parks. You had him on before, right?
Oh yeah. No, I'm due to have Andy back, especially considering he's been writing so many good books lately. I thought he did a great job with Brubaker on that Daredevil annual.
No, definitely. And the new one just came out. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but I thought the new one is out.
Yes, it is. Absolutely, it was good.
He's a delight. But it's a page from, I'm trying to.
I know you were saying Journey into Mystery. I think 160.
Yeah, the Journey into Mystery issue.
It was like 160 something.
Time. Damn it! Oh, here we go. Let's see. Journey into Mystery 115.
Okay.
And it's the only page that Frank Giacoya.
That's
it, right? It's the only, and in Andy's opinion, Frank is Kirby's best inker.
And
that's
interesting.
Why Andy owns the page. It's the only time Frank inked Kirby on Thor. Is this one Journey into Mystery? So it's the page. It's the page of Andy.
Wow.
Yeah. And I wanted Andy to let me tear up a little bit of it and smoke it. I wanted to see, like, listen. It's Kirby art. It's priceless. I understand that. But look, if the three of us—it was me, it was Andy, and Tony Moore.
Okay.
Listen. If the three of us smoke this page of Kirby right now, we will be legends. They will talk about that in comics for 50. It would be forever. And hey, maybe people think we're morons. You know, a lot of people. Andy certainly thought I was a moron just for suggesting it. But listen, if we were the guys that smoked a page of pure Kirby to see what happened, we could eat and drink on. We could eat out and drink out on that story at conventions for the rest of our lives. We could just make up all these great. Like, that's the root of an amazing comic urban legend. Let's get into it. And they were all like, "Oh, don't! No, oh, no, it's art. Oh, it's Decker, it's precious, it's priceless. And then wine, you know."
I do.
Like, geez, Andy, where do you hide the skirts and that giant?
With your hat collection, with your impressive fedora collection, Andy.
Exactly. You find so many fedoras that go so well with your precious nun habits.
We again, in the abortive conversation that unfortunately didn't make it, and it's too bad because we had some gems. We were talking about Kirby, and you were marveling at how, no pun intended, marveling, how this, you know, kind of real, you know, proletariat kind of guy, this working class guy.
Just Mr. Meat and Potatoes, Mr. Salt of the Earth, Lower East Side.
5 foot tall, 5 foot nothing guy.
5 foot nothing, you know, Jewish kid from the Lower East Side, you know, first, second generation, you know, army guy, married out of high school, you know, father, working guy, working class, blue collar Joe becomes obsessed with, like, how does Kirby become obsessed with God and angels and evolution and the nature of man? And like, a good period of, like, the last, you know, 5-6 years of Kirby's time in comics before he went to animation, that was what he was doing. You know, he was, like, obsessed. Like, he was convinced that God looked like a giant robot. Like, why did he get these ideas? How do these thoughts occur to you? Where did they, what happened? Where do these thoughts enter you? And that's Kirby. That's the genius. That's the sheer miracle of the guy. Is there's no logical explanation why that man should have thoughts the size he had them. There's no logic behind why that man thought as big as he did, but thank God he did.
No, I loved, we talked about, you know, just that period of the early 70s when he was doing the Fourth World for DC, and then he came back to Marvel, and yeah, just the trippy stuff, the Eternals that he was working on, and 2001.
I just went back and reread the Eternals, and the Eternals makes the Fourth World look like a child's Bible primer. You know what I mean? Like, if you think the Fourth World deals with some heavy shit, like, no. The Fourth World, that's the watered down, that's the entertainment version, man. The Eternals is the real deal. The Eternals is berserk and heavy and just full of all this insane ensemble book where, like, the main character disappears for issues at a time, and it's just never anything like that.
You know, I have to admit, I haven't read Gaiman and Romita's redo on the Eternals, and I know that that's, you know, it ends up playing an important part in the current Marvel universe, because I know that it's playing out on things like the Hulk book and things like that, or I should say the Hercules book right now. But
even a little bit of a wave, it's going to find its way into X-Men too.
Oh, wow. I've been waiting for the trade on the Omega the Unknown thing that Jonathan Latham is doing. And I was wondering, have you been following that story?
I have, and I think it's terrific. And it's, you know, it's great. It's really great. And, you know, they got Gary Panther to do issues, right? He did issue 7's cover, and he had like 8 pages in issue 7.
Oh, that's
Gary
really cool.
Gary Panther in a Marvel comic.
Wow. Yeah. Man. Any thoughts on, you know, while I got you, we lost a couple greats this year so far, unfortunately. Dave Stevens and Steve Gerber. Were you a Steve Gerber fan growing up?
I think it's impossible to not have been influenced by the guy. And so, you know what I mean? Gerber, Engelhart, there's a cluster of guys that just, it's impossible to kind of come around when guys my age did and not be touched by them, you know? He built some very important bridges that the rest of us walk across every single day and don't think twice about. That's a real priceless contribution to an art form.
And he was still, I mean, that Hard Time.
Yeah.
It was such a great, you know, book, and I felt so bad that it just never really found its audience, because it was one of the smartest things, and it's like, you know, I understood what DiDio was trying to do with this new imprint, but it's like, why isn't this thing a Vertigo book? Because that's where it needed to be. That's the audience that needed to know about this thing. And it's too bad. I mean, I think DiDio, when he first joined DC, or became the executive editor, he had already been at DC, but had a lot of really ambitious non-superhero ideas that he wanted as a part of the DC universe or as part of this new Focus imprint. And it just, you know, unfortunately, I think everyone just kind of balks at a new idea sometimes. As you you're obviously having that issue in some circles with Casanova, I would imagine.
Sure, with Casanova, with The Order too, you know.
Sure.
The direct market is designed to sell Batman, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a reason why Batman is the median gauge for, you know, the numbers in the sales chart.
Yep.
You know? The decimal is built on Batman, and I find that literal and figurative in a lot of different ways. You know, I don't want to like talk ill of DC necessarily, but a lot of times, like, it always feels to me like DC is trying to catch lightning in a bottle, which we all are in a way, but they only have patience to give it about 20 minutes before they call it a day. You know what I mean? And the focus line was like that, you know, well, first off, we're going to launch 4 titles all at once that look different than everything else that are, you know what I mean? We're going to do this all at once. So there's no chance to actually build the line. We're just going to fully form this line that's going to spring forth onto the world, and everything's getting 8 issues. It's like, wow, I think those books, especially a book like Hard Time, and Fraction wasn't so bad. I'm mm-hmm. saying that more, you know, not just because it shares my fake name. it's sort of like with DC, sometimes it feels like if it's not a hit right out of the gate, like it loses all support, you know.
Well,
and this is a marketplace right now and an industry where new ideas, different ideas, really need a kind of a gentle, nurturing hand and a patient hand that's quite honestly willing to lose a little money while the idea takes hold.
Well, and not to be a DC apologist, but in fairness, they did, in the case of Hard Time, give it a second season. And I know that there were, you know, look what they're doing with Manhunter as well. I think, you know, Draco is certainly getting that second chance. And, you know, honestly, I would more focus on it in the same way that when Jemison Quesada first took over Marvel, there were a lot of initiatives and a lot of books kind of thrown against the wall. And, you know, a lot of books kind of suffered the same fate as well. So I understand. And it's, you know, the only reason why I bring up the balance of pointing out some of the Marvel cases and some of the cases where DC did try to stand behind a book and give it a second chance, much like Marvel did with Spider-Girl. I mean, certainly, to their credit, listened to the audience and said, no, we really like this book. Please keep it around. Find a way to keep it around. But, look at Chris Priest had that problem with the Crew.
Yeah.
There was an interesting 6-issue. God, what Bruce Jones was doing with Kingpin I thought was fascinating, and it never found its audience. You obviously suffered that fate with The Order as well. I mean, you know, like I said, I think you kind of were able to kind of come to some closure, you know.
It's as much a, you know, you can definitely have a lot of...
I'm laughing at your dog, man.
Yeah, I'm sorry, there's somebody outside screaming, and I set the dog off. what can you do with dogs? I think it's an industry-wide problem, you know what I mean? I don't know, maybe that's it. Maybe 8 issues is enough, you know what I mean? Maybe if a book hasn't found its footing after 8 issues, then it never will, I don't know.
No, like you said, I think it goes back to your original point of the direct market is geared to sell Batman, and we've got to find a way of breaking through that, and hopefully there are, you know, I can appreciate from the merchant standpoint as well.
To look at sort of the way the model has changed very recently, look at the numbers that Vertigo Books are doing. It's like Vertigo has realized that, you know what, we might not have it in issue sales, but boy, we're going to get it in trade. And so now there are books that are actually doing, you know, worse than what a book like Hard Time did, that are going on unimpeded.
That's true.
Because the book market has really come up, you know. So, yeah, once again, it was Steve Gerber being ahead of his time one more time.
Yeah. Well, and, I'm glad you mentioned that, too, because, yeah, look at The Exterminators. I mean, they kind of kept that series around.
They kept it going for a good long time.
Yeah, you know, and our pal Tony, unfortunately, they got to wrap that thing up. So
yeah,
that's too bad.
Yeah, you know, it does good in trades, and you know, they're definitely letting trades. They understand now, I think, the trade sales will keep a book around longer than 8 issues. So you know, it's tough. It's tough.
Well, let's hope Casanova, you know, does well enough that. The third arc is given, and when you guys all get back together, we will see that. But
fingers crossed. Yeah, we all want to do it, and that's sort of the you know, we're all used to not making any money at it, so that won't be anything new. It's just, you know, it's just a matter of time. So best case is we can find some scratch and make it happen a little faster.
Well, let's move on. Let's talk about Thor, because
all right,
that was outstanding. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much.
Very funny.
So fun to write that book.
And once again. Dipping from last night, I must point out the narration was outstanding, and in my mind, and I didn't ask you if you had a voice in your head, and you probably have millions of voices in your head, but for the specific narrator, I heard John Huston as the lawgiver in the Planet of the Apes movies, kind of, and it was foretold.
And now that is all I'm going to be able to think when I write the book is John Huston.
Good. And Thor one day spoke to Loki, and he said, in that great kind of creepy grandpa voice, Grandpa's been taking too much of the bourbon lately.
I think I'm going to have another sherry. I don't care if I've had my dessert. I'm John Huston.
Angelica, don't talk back to me and tell Danny to go make his own fucking movies. Isn't he making an Orson Welles movie or something, Danny Huston?
Did he?
Have you heard about that or no?
I haven't. That's great, though.
Andy Parks and I were talking about that. He wants to do that period of time when Orson Welles was in Europe and would see, which mobster was it? New York mobster that was exiled. He couldn't go back to America.
I have no idea. This is fascinating to me.
In that Peter Bogdanovich Orson Welles book, they talk about how he got to know this one mobster. And he knew he had to be nice to him because the guy still had power and stuff, but he was also kind of afraid every time he'd see him. And yeah, wow. I can't remember which guy it was. Danny Huston's doing this like kind of fictionalized thing, and Orson's going to be kind of this, you know, uncovering some sort of mystery. And it's like, you know, the real story is interesting enough. I don't think you need to, you know, mess around and fake something here, Danny. So John would have killed him for doing that.
No one can say this line of dialogue. The suitcase wasn't haunted, Danny. Your father would never direct a film like this. So I'm trying to do Drunk Orson from that Mrs. Paul's Fish documentary.
Yes, I have.
We know a vineyard in Southern California. No one would say this is an old Drunk Orson.
I have heard that. That's awesome. That is, you know, they made a Pinky in the Brain cartoon where they literally took all that dialogue except for when Orson was swearing. Oh, man.
I would never ask anyone to say this. It means you need it for $1,000. I'll pay you $1,000,000 if you can say that.
Oh, dear. Back to Thor. Ages of Thunder.
Right. Let's just do John Huston and Orson Welles as roommates. Like old drunk roommates. Like, have you ever heard Raymond and Peter?
No. What's Raymond and Peter?
Oh, my God. Okay, Raymond and Peter were two drunks. Hardcore, you know, wet brain drunks that lived in a flea bag apartment in San Francisco, and this was in the early 80s, and their next door neighbors were convinced that Raymond and Peter would at one night in a drunken rage kill them, so they began to record Raymond and Peter's fighting.
They made like comedy albums of it or whatever.
Ended up being comedy albums. It started as being just protection, so in case, you know, Raymond and Peter went nuts one night, they would have evidence. But now it's become this, but it's these great, dude, I'll send it to you. Cause it's
I would like to hear that.
Shut up, little man. The album is called Shut Up, Little Man. You're a little man, and I hate you, and you're weak. It's just the most berserk and insane. So if you and me did Orson Welles and John Huston as Raymond and Peter, at like a dinner theater.
I think we got something. I left a stretch sock on the doorknob. Clearly that meant I
would never do that to your roommate in a million years. It's ridiculous, John. Jesus Christ, the Maltese Falcon was 80 years ago.
How am I supposed to let you know I'm going to get laid in the apartment if I don't give you a signal?
Jesus Christ, I want to know that you're getting laid at all.
Guy, we need a good like artist to like do it like a flash cartoon and have like...
Have you seen actually the F for Fake Criterion?
Yes, I have.
With the Orson Welles' one-man band, which might be my favorite documentary of all time.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great movie. And, man, his chick at the end, she was smoking. Holy shit.
Yeah, I tell you.
Oda, whatever her name was. Oh, my God.
Oda Kier, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Still had it.
Yeah, man, you know, for a 400-pound man, exactly. I don't know where my cock is, but Oda certainly does.
Houston. That's even better. But I love the idea that Orson thought a good movie would be him reading Moby Dick to camera. I've got an idea for Moby Dick. I'm going to read it to camera.
People will come and
see it in my living room starting on Tuesday. It'll cost $400. Can I borrow $400?
God, that's... I'm telling you, man. I have seen that documentary. That's amazing. And it's so sad because, yeah, I mean, he really was just scrambling for any penny he could to finish the other side of the wind.
Although, rumor has it, Bogdanovich is swearing, we are going to see the other side of the wind sooner rather than later.
Wow.
That there has been materials recovered, and he's been assembling an edit. And it's really, I'm a little surprised it hasn't happened already based on a couple of interviews I've read. But,
wow.
Bogdanovich is swearing that the other side of the wind is very close to reality.
This was Orson Welles' last film, for people who don't know what the hell we're talking about. And Bogdanovich was in it, and actually John Huston was in it as well.
Exactly, as Orson Welles.
Exactly. He said if he couldn't get Huston, he would have played the role himself. He said, but I really want John to play the role.
And if Bogdanovich, as a young filmmaker, which he was, and just kind of, it looks, you can see in these documentaries, these little snippets of it, and it just looks berserk. It just looks completely insane.
Thanks, Matt. Jesus Christ, it's 12:20. I apologize. It truly was, but I think
that 45 minutes was bad. John Huston and bad. Actually, it was a good John Huston. It was bad Orson Welles.
No, you were fine. I just did at first. It sounded like Dean Martin. Other than what's
did I tell you that I bought that 33-disc bootleg of the Dean Martin variety show at Wizard World LA?
Nice. No, but
33 DVDs, my friend.
That's a lot of Foster Brooks to get through.
That is an awful lot of Foster Brooks and an awful lot of, like, falling down the, you know, going down the fire pole.
Oh, it's the variety show. It's not
it's
the roast.
Yeah, it's the variety show.
So you got Dom DeLuise and, of course, Kenny Lane, my fine piano player.
Yeah, and it's this weird kind of, like the producer of the show is the one who put it out.
Greg Garrison.
So he's got, it's kind of like this hosted segments where he's like, oh yeah, you know, funny thing about Dean is Dean wasn't really a drunk. You know what I mean? So it's just kind of weird, like, it just feels I've only watched 3 or 4 of them so far, but it's felt like a 4-hour, like, infomercial for the Dean Martin roast. So
that's outstanding.
It's just great. It's just the best money I've ever spent in my entire life. And that includes the money we paid to have a cesarean section for my son.
Very nice. I can't let that go because the Dean Martin variety show was a staple in the Suntress household. My father was totally of the cocktail generation, as I always tell Clay Moore. And
cocktail generation.
And that's really it's the nicest way to call the boozers.
It is. No, you're right.
Well, honestly, my friend and I have had this discussion where there are alcoholics and there are boozers. And the 5 p.m. cocktail generation didn't necessarily mean they were alcoholics. It was like smoking. That's just what everybody did. And especially that show, what I loved about the Dean Martin show was they had that kind of fake house that he would, like, have as a set. And he'd always, like, kind of sit in that couch. But he'd always be in a tuxedo.
Yeah.
And it just never made sense to me that the guy's relaxing at home. It's like, where's the cardigan that, like, he wears in Ocean's 11 or something like that? But no, Pally, I got to have my tux on and let me.
Now, you heard the stories about that, right?
No.
When he took the job, NBC offered it to him. And he agreed to do it only if they paid him a ridiculous amount of money. They gave him
stock.
I don't think it was stock. But it was, okay. He did a lot of money, and he didn't want to rehearse. And so he would show up Friday morning at 9 o'clock. The directors and the writers would have put the show together, and he would, like, rehearse and kind of drill it, and then they would shoot it. And that's why it had that kind of crazy
loose.
Improvisational feel is because a lot of it was kind of crazy and improvisational. Because Dean would show up like Friday night, they'd shoot it, they'd go, all right, good night, see you next week.
I don't like to work too hard, Pally.
Yeah, exactly. I can't believe you said yes to this, and now he'd go.
So
it had this incredibly loose, incredibly casual thing to it because it was incredibly loose and incredibly casual.
Well, and they had good comedians on that show. Bob Newhart was a regular kind of
guest
star.
I saw a sketch on one of the episodes that was Rowan and Martin and Bill Cosby.
There's a good combination.
Yeah, and then Dean shows up at the end. And there's a sketch that was Peter Sellers, Dom DeLuise, Flip Wilson, and Dean Martin.
Outstanding.
And apparently between dress and air, Sellers decided he was a guy getting his hair cut.
Okay. Oh, yeah, they always could go to the barbershop, and Dom DeLuise was one of the barbers. That's right.
Yeah, and it was Dom DeLuise and Flip Wilson are the barbers. And it's between dress and air, Peter Sellers decided to do his character's voice as that of a mincing queen.
Okay.
And he didn't tell anyone he was going to do this. He just starts to do it. And DeLuise and Flip Wilson lose their shit and try to keep it going, try to keep the show together. And Sellers is the only one who's on script. And then it gets so ridiculous, just Dean just comes in, like, in the talk, like, hey, boys, what's going on? I'm like, oh, look, Dean's here. Like, it's just, it's chaos. I'm like, this was your job, Dean Martin. God bless you. Yeah, and then, you know, and then, sure, you know what's going to be awesome? The Gold Diggers. Huh? What? Is he just like crazy? Like, kind of things were still, like, politically incorrect. And
well, it was kind of like the last round for the Rat Pack. I mean, his show kind of represented that vibe that you hear about from the early 60s. And, you know, he kept it going on his show through the 70s, up until they finally got rid of the variety show and they made it the Celebrity Roasts.
The Celebrity Roasts, yeah. And there's a Newhart sketch where he and Dean are, like, journalists that have infiltrated a nudist camp. So the joke is just they're naked the whole time, and, like, oh, God. It's just like, I can't believe that this used to be on television.
That's fantastic.
But this was free. This was on the public airwaves, man.
Jesus. Well, hang in there, Matt, because I honestly think, much like Brubaker has found a new audience in his Marvel work, I hope that that is translated into people reaching back, grabbing things that he did at Wildstorm, like Sleeper, the Gotham Central stuff he did with Rucka, and obviously now, you know, his stuff with Criminal. And I have a feeling that as time progresses and more people, you know, get into your mainstream stuff, you'll, you know, just like Bendis and the Jinx World stuff, I think that stuff eventually will find its audience. And people will reach back, and more people can enjoy Last of the Independents like I did. You know,
wow,
I mean,
fingers crossed. That'd be great.
Five Fists of Science, The Great Rex Mantooth, The Fraction Collection,
the Hallmark. These are the watchwords of my education.
Well, thanks for doing this bonus episode, and I really enjoyed the Casanova arc.
Thank you, sir. I really appreciate that, and you know, there's a you're very much my target audience, so it does my heart good to hear that you dug it. So thanks for sticking with me.
We talk business, and then it's like, all right, and here's some bullshit that we
can. And it's just we're just shooting shit in the bar, man.
Exactly. Dude, that's the point of the show. That's exactly the point of the show.
It's, that was the original title, but it looked bad in iTunes.
Exactly, so I chose Word Balloon. There you go. Complete analysis of Casanova 14, along with some back matter chat with Matt Fraction. We hope you enjoyed this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks a lot for listening. This episode was brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com, where they offer a huge selection of trade paperbacks, hardcovers, essentials, showcases, archives, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more, all at up to 35% off, with orders over $50 receiving free shipping. And as I said earlier, you can pick up Luxuria, the first arc of Casanova, which is collected in trade, both as a hardback and softcover editions. The hardback retails for $24.99, the in-stock trade price just $15.74, and for the softcover edition, $12.99 is the retail price, just $8.18 when you visit InStockTrades.com. And don't forget to visit InStockTrades' sister site, Discount Comic Book Service, at DCBService.com for all your pre-order needs. Major publishers are 40% off, and monthly specials are 45% to 75% off every month. Visit InStockTrades at InStockTrades.com and Discount Comic Book Service at DCBService.com. Thanks again for listening. This is John Suntress. Don't forget, Word Balloon is all over the internet. You can find us at Newsarama.com. We're also at iTunes if you search for Word Balloon, Podcast Alley, Podcast Pickle, Odeo, all the various podcatching sites. We're at Last.fm as well, at MySpace.com/WordBalloon, ComicSpace.com/WordBalloon. And as always, any questions or comments on the show, you can reach me via email, john@wordballoon.com. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2008.